You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 133 by Rudolf Steiner, 9 lectures entitled Earthly and Cosmic Man, translated by Dorothy Osmond and Clifford Venno. This is Lecture 7, given in Berlin on May 20th, 1912. The last lecture dealt with the subject of how the Christ impulse will unfold in future times, and also, of course, in our own epoch. We heard that sheaths will weave themselves, as it were, around the Christ impulse, wonder into an astral body, feelings of love or compassion into an etheric body, the power of conscience into what corresponds to a physical body. Thereby that ideal being whose I, capital, the Christ impulse itself, passed into the earth through the mystery of Golgotha, will reach completion in the course of the time still remaining to earth evolution. The fundamental character of the future ideal of humanity was described in one of its aspects, and the present lecture will endeavor to add yet another different picture. The Christ impulse came, so to speak, in the middle of the age following upon the great Atlantean catastrophe. This age may be said to extend from the time of the Atlantean catastrophe to the next great catastrophe, of which you may read in the lectures on the Apocalypse. In the middle of this period, the most important of all events in Earth evolution takes place, the coming of the Christ impulse. As the last lecture indicated, it is not necessary to turn our eyes to Palestine in order to realize that something of the highest importance was taking place at that time in Earth evolution. We have only to study the Greco-Latin epoch of culture, lying as it does in the middle of the post-Atlantean period, and recall one of its characteristic features. This again can be compared with a similar feature in the preceding third epoch and in our own epoch. The essential and fundamental character of a Greek temple has often been described. Its form stands there as a complete, self-contained, independent whole, even when it is not actually before our eyes, even when we conceive of no human being anywhere near it. Inside a Greek temple, human beings always seem to be a disturbing element. They do not really belong to it. They do not belong inside it. For what in reality is a Greek temple? We can only understand it in its whole form and structure if we think of it as the dwelling place of a living, invisible God who has come down to the physical plane. That is the reason why every temple is dedicated to one particular God. And when we picture the God in the temple with no human beings present, the God for whom a dwelling place has been built on earth, then we have grasped the idea embodied in the Greek temple. Human beings really have no place there. This was the idea underlying the whole architecture of a Greek temple. Such architecture could only arise in an epoch when the divine spiritual was known to pervade all existence on the physical plane. People whose paths appeared to be everywhere steeped in the divine could feel all the depth of meaning contained in words uttered by one of them. Quote, "Better it is to be a beggar in the upper world than a king in the realm of the shades." Close quote. That is to say, in the world lying on the other side of the gate of death. It was the period when human beings experienced in greatest intensity their union with the physical plane and with the spiritual pervading the physical plane. Let us compare a Greek temple with a building of the same character in the preceding epoch, and with buildings which in our own epoch indicate its fundamental attitude and trend. Think of an Egyptian temple, even of the pyramids. they become intelligible only when we see them as expressions of man's aspiration to the divine, to the divine Godhead, who has not yet descended to the physical plane. In the architecture of the Egyptian time, every line, every form, expresses the striving of man toward the divine spiritual. But these mysterious and deeply symbolical buildings indicate in themselves that men must have undergone preparation before the architectural forms could help them to find the way to the divine spiritual. They needed preparation. They needed to have reached the first stage of initiation. The same applies to the architecture of Asia Minor. In our own epoch, Gothic architecture gives the keynote. This is an occult fact. It is impossible to have the same conception of a Gothic cathedral as of a Greek temple, for a Gothic cathedral is incomplete without the congregation of believers. It is simply not complete without the human beings within it. All its forms seem to convey that they are there to receive the prayers of the believers, in contrast to the initiates in ancient Egypt. Anyone who can discern what these things mean realizes from the course taken by the evolution of form from the Egyptian temple through the Greek temple to the Gothic cathedral that the impulse leading to the unfolding of the human eye, capital, entered at a certain point into the process of earthly existence. Wherever we look, we can perceive how the Christ impulse lays hold of man, leaves its stamp and signature upon all happenings, all development. And it seems grotesque when philosophical or theological thought declares that acceptance of such an impulse rests upon the basis of historical records. It does not rest upon any historical record whatever, but simply and solely upon a discerning, clear-sighted observation of human evolution. For no matter where we look, we see that evolution follows the same course as that revealed in architecture. The initiate who alone was capable of understanding the architectural forms of the Egypto-Chaldean epoch, the third post-Atlantean epoch, knew that he must raise himself above the level of ordinary human nature. Then and only then could he ascend into the region of divine spiritual life. The initiate of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch knew that in the physical world he was living together with the divine, but he had very little connection with what the Greeks called the world of shades, because by that time man had descended more deeply into physical existence. And when the gods did not mingle with men in the temples, the Greeks felt no connection with that other world. Since the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, these conditions have changed. Changed in the sense that it is possible now for every single soul to find the path to the divine spiritual. It is extremely important to realize this, for it is the most concrete expression of the fact that in ancient times, men were much nearer to the spiritual in their consciousness, in their knowledge, and in their life of soul. Then came the descent to the physical plane, and now there must be a gradual re-ascent. We are living in the age when the re-ascent must be undertaken consciously, whereas, to begin with, the Christ impulse worked unconsciously in men. Our own epoch is a kind of recapitulation of the Egypto-Chaldean period. Of the Greco-Latin epoch, there is no recapitulation, for it lies in the middle of the seven consecutive periods. The third epoch is being recapitulated, in a certain form, in our own age. The second epoch, that of the ancient Persian culture, will be recapitulated in the sixth epoch, which will follow our own, and in the far distant seventh epoch, before a stupendous catastrophe, the first epoch, that of ancient Indian culture, will be recapitulated. Not, of course, in the same form, for the recapitulation will everywhere bear the imprint of the Christ impulse. A certain consciousness existed, especially in olden times, of what has come to pass in the evolution of mankind. ancient times, of course, were especially conscious of the descent of humanity, the descent to the physical plane from the heights of divine spiritual existence. But for every process there must be a preparation. There had been a preparation, too, for the impulse given by the mystery of Golgotha in the fourth epoch, the impulse for the re-ascent. This impulse had its forerunners in Elijah, John the Baptist, and others. But consciousness of the fact that mankind has descended from divine spiritual existence and in the future must re-ascend into the worlds of divine spirit was present not only in the culture, which eventually made its way into the West. Evidence of such consciousness is to be found in every civilization. A very widespread and characteristic idea finds expression in the traditions of practically all peoples, an idea which can, it is true, be applied widely, but which, in its final phase, is to be associated with a definite and specific tradition. It is a tradition upon which there has been much reflection, and upon which occult knowledge alone can shed light, namely the tradition of the flood. Much that is connected with this tradition refers, of course, to far earlier times, but the following is brought clearly to light by occult investigation. Nearly all the peoples who have left reliable historical records or legends refer to the flood as having taken place about 3,000 years before the mystery of Golgotha. That is the period indicated by the legends. There is not enough time today to explain why this last flood, which was supposed to have occurred 3,000 years before our era, cannot be taken to indicate a great physical catastrophe or deluge. Obviously, it does not refer to the Atlantean catastrophe, for that took place very much earlier. The flood, in quotes, therefore, must mean something entirely different. Yet the fact should not be lost sight of that the traditions of all the peoples in question place the flood in the fourth millennium before our era. Although the dates vary a little, they tally in the main essentials. At this point, I will ask you to remember that in the first post-Atlantean epoch, when the holy rishis were the great teachers of humanity, culture was inspired primarily by the human etheric body. During the ancient Persian epoch, culture was inspired by the astral body, the sentient body. In the Egypto-Chaldean epoch, by the sentient soul. In the Greco-Latin epoch, by the mind or intellectual soul. In our present epoch, by the consciousness soul. And now the time is approaching when the powers of the spirit self will gradually be imbued into culture. In that evolution proceeded in this way, the experiences arising in man's life of soul underwent deep and far-reaching change. Just think of it. The picture of the world presented to a man of the earliest Indian epoch, of which even the Vedas have no knowledge, received its essential character and stamp from the working of the etheric body. Through the etheric body, man cannot direct his gaze to the outer world in the way that is customary in our time. His perception, his picture of the world, cannot be as it is today. Where the forces of the etheric body are in operation, everything arises from within. A person of today can only have an idea, dim and lifeless at that, of perception that derives from the etheric body when he recalls the character of his dreams. But the dreams and visions through which during the ancient Indian epoch one human being became known to another were living and real in the very highest degree. To imagine that when one human being met another, the outer perception of him was the same as it is today would be quite erroneous. The man of ancient India saw pictures, but in those times the other human being physically before him was enveloped in an auric cloud, shrouded in a kind of mist. The character of perception was altogether different compared with perception as it is at the present day. These pictures, although full of the greatest spiritual import, were blurred and hazy. the forces streaming down from cosmic space, from the world of the stars. It was these forces that were seen in such clarity and brilliance in those ancient times. In the second post-Atlantean epoch, the power to look outward gradually unfolded, but strangely enough, the faculty for gazing into the great cosmic spaces remained. Whereas perceptions of the world below were still hazy and without definition, the ancient Persian gazed with lucid clarity into the world of the stars. It is therefore intelligible that Zarathustrianism should point directly to cosmic space, to the light of the sun, to Ahura Mazda or Ormuzd. This was because the astral body was primarily active. By the end of the ancient Persian epoch, the faculty of looking outward into the physical world was already in its preparatory stage. The impulses leading to perception as it is in our day have been developing for long, long ages. Thus the impulse to look out into the physical world was gradually instilled into man, leading him to the entirely new mode of perception, which began to light up by slow degrees. When the ancient Persian epoch was drawing to its close, and the next period was glimmering like a dawn of the future, people felt, quote, "We shall no longer be able to experience with such intensity the divine heritage that has come to us from the olden days of Atlantis, when, with their power of inner clairvoyant vision, men lived in communion with the worlds of divine spirit." Close quote. The gaze was turned back to the past. What mattered most for these people were their remembrances, in which living pictures arose like dreams. Dreams of how the gods had fashioned the world through the ages of Lemuria and Atlantis. They felt that these remembrances were withdrawing, were fading away from humanity, and that conditions were approaching when man must work with a faculty which tells him of the outer world, clouds the bright light of the inner world of the spirit, and compels him to look from within outward, if he is to master the external world. This age was drawing nearer and nearer. Those who had the deepest, clearest perception of the dawn of the new epoch were people who at that time were the initiates in ancient India. They felt it in the form, as it were, of a divine impulse, compelling the human being to think for himself through inner activity about what confronts him in the physical world to which he was descending. Picturing this impulse as a divine being, the successors of the first very ancient Indian culture, those who were living now during the second post-Atlantean epoch, called this being Pramati. These people felt, quote, "The god Pramati is drawing near, snatching human beings away from the guidance given by the ancient gods. Pramati is causing the disappearance of everything which ancient clairvoyance revealed concerning the world, and is forcing man to look outward into the physical plane. Darkness is creeping over the world of the ancient gods. A time is approaching when in their life of soul men will no longer be able to gaze into the world of the gods, but will only turn their eyes to the outer world. Kali Yuga, the Black Age, is approaching. The bright age of ancient divinity is giving place to the age when the gods of old withdraw. It is the age inaugurated by the god Pramati." Close quote. Kali Yuga was said to begin at a time which lies 3,101 years before our own era. This is the time of the flood, according to Indian tradition. For it was said that the flood coincides with the coming of Kali Yuga, and Kali Yuga was conceived to be the offspring of the god Pramati. Kali Yuga broke in upon the world, reaching its close in our own age. Now that the ascent to the spiritual world must begin, a spiritual science has come to mankind. Kali Yuga began 3,101 years before our era and ended in the year 1899 AD. That is why 1899 is a year of such importance. The re-ascent to the spiritual worlds, this must be the ideal of the future. The age preceding the onset of Kali Yuga was, however, an age characteristic of the ancient Persian epoch, when the old remembrances rose up within man via the astral body. Now he was to turn to the world outside. This was a great and epoch-making transition. In the case of many human beings, it came about in such a way that for a time all vision departed from them, and darkness spread over their souls. This condition of darkness did not last for long periods, actually only for weeks, but people passed into this condition of sleep, and many never came out of it. Many of them perished, and only relatively few were left in widely scattered regions. There is not enough time today to describe the conditions actually prevailing at that time. It can only be said briefly that owing to so large a number of human beings having succumbed, conditions were dark and sinister in the extreme, and at only a few scattered places did people awaken from the great spiritual deluge that spread over their souls like a sleep. This condition of sleep was felt by most souls as a kind of drowning, and by only a few as a reawakening. And then came the Black Age, the age devoid of the gods. Were these things known to other human beings on the earth? They were indeed. To our astonishment, we find widespread evidence of knowledge among the peoples that a deluge had submerged the consciousness of men, and that in the third post-Atlantean epoch, through the development of the sentient soul, in other words, outward-turned vision, an entirely new power must have been inaugurated. The Indians divined this when they said Kali Yuga is the offspring of Pramati. And what did the Greeks say? In Greece, Pramati becomes Prometheus, which is exactly the same. Prometheus is the brother of Epimetheus. The latter represents one who still looks back into ancient times. Epimetheus is the one whose thoughts turn backward. Prometheus sends his thoughts forward to the world outside, to what takes place there. Just as Pramati has his offspring in Kali Yuga, so too Prometheus has his offspring. The Greek form of Kali Yuga is Kalyan, and because the Greeks felt it to be the age of darkness, the D is prefixed, and the word becomes Dukalyan, which is really the same word as Kali Yuga. This is not ingenious fancy, but an occult fact. It is clear, therefore, that the Greeks possessed the same knowledge as the Indian sages. This is quoted merely as an example, indicating that in their conditions of old clairvoyance, knowledge of these truths came to human beings, and they were able to express them in majestic pictures. The Greek legend tells how, on the advice of his father, Prometheus, Deucalion builds a wooden chest. In this he and his wife Pyrrha alone are saved from destruction when Zeus proposes to exterminate the human race by a deluge. Deucalion and Pyrrha land on Parnassus, and from them issues the new human race. Deucalion is the son of Prometheus, and in the intervening period comes the flood, denoting among manifold peoples a condition of consciousness. These wonderful pictures, which have been preserved in the traditions of so many of the peoples, show us how truths concerning the evolution of mankind have survived among them. As humanity lived on gradually into the age of Kali Yuga, into the third post-Atlantean epoch, the ancient clairvoyant knowledge faded away. We who have to recapitulate the third epoch must now bring this kind of knowledge to life once again, but in an entirely new form. The lecture given a fortnight ago dealt with this subject. Western culture, the beginnings of which were mingled with the ancient Hebrew culture, has to concentrate primary attention on the single personality living on the physical plane between birth and death. Western culture cannot focus its main attention on the individuality who passes through the different epochs, but concentrates upon the existence of the one personality, whose life between birth and death runs its course on the physical plane, not in the higher worlds. Now that Kali Yuga has come to an end, consciousness must be imbued with the forces necessary for the further evolution of the human race. What was lost during Kali Yuga must be raised again from the depths. Our eyes must be directed more and more to the onflowing life of the individuality. I have spoken of a series of lives in the West: Elijah, John the Baptist, Raphael, Novalis, and have shown how, by the addition of knowledge derived from the spiritual worlds, we can perceive the continuous thread of the soul, the onflowing life of the one individuality in Elijah, John the Baptist, Raphael, Novalis. In our spiritual movement, development of this insight must be a conscious aspiration, for it is a necessity in the evolution and culture of the earth. No progress would be possible by the mere continuation of the old experiences, the old knowledge. I have emphasized often enough all that it means for the human mind to enrich and make fruitful the heritage of ancient times by means of the new knowledge now available. It must, however, be realized that just as the transition from life inspired by the astral body to a spiritual life of soul, primarily in the sentient soul, was fraught with deep significance, so now we must work our way from life in the consciousness soul to life in the spirit self. I have intimated how this will take place by saying that during the next 3,000 years, an increasing number of human beings will experience the appearance of the Christ impulse, will be able to experience the Christ impulse in the spiritual worlds. But actual realization of the influences streaming in from the spiritual world will have to unfold in greater intensity in the times lying ahead of us. It will not suffice to know in a general way, in theory, that the human being lives on after death. Man's whole picture of life must carry the sure conviction that when the human being passes through the gate of death, he lives on still, death being merely a transition. We must realize, not as a theory, but as actual knowledge, that while a human being is alive, he works upon us physically through his body. After his death, he works spiritually, out of the spiritual world, upon our physical world. He is present in very truth. We must learn to see life in the light of such a fact and to reckon with what it involves. Suppose it is our task to educate children. Anyone acquainted with these things is well aware that to educate children who, up to their 20th year, still have parents living is a very different matter from having to educate children whose fathers died when they were 4 or 5 years old. When education is taken in deep earnestness, and the individuality of the child really studied, it is not a matter of speculation, especially in the case of a child whose father is dead. We shall often discern that there is something unusual at work here, something we cannot at first quite get hold of. Moreover, we shall not succeed in getting to the root of it by adopting the modes of thought drawn from materialism. But here and there the thought may occur, quote, "Here is a strange current of the times. Most people regard those who belong to it as fools, but it may be worthwhile to find out what these theosophists have to say about the destiny of human beings after death. The theosophists tell us that although human beings discard their physical bodies at death, the content of their life of soul, their hopes, aspirations, and so forth, live on and are not inactive. Indeed, they are often more active after death than when the human being was living on the physical plane, enclosed in his body." Close quote. Those who speak like this have paid attention to the results of spiritual research and will realize that the father is working upon the child from the spiritual world, and moreover, that he has definite hopes and longings which make their way into the life of the child. With this knowledge, success may come where it was not possible before, and we know how to deal with sympathies and antipathies which may express themselves in the child. To succeed with children, we need to know more than that the air affects them, and that when the air is chilly they may catch cold. We must have knowledge of the influences playing from the spiritual world into the physical, and of the form they take. These things are still regarded as nonsense, but the time is not far distant when the very facts of life will compel people to take account of them, and to reckon with what endures in the form of living and potent impulses after human beings have passed through death. Not until then will the concrete reality contained in the spiritual conception of the world be grasped. Naturally, these influences from the spiritual world are not at work in the case of children only. Influences also come from individualities in the spiritual world who are connected with human beings at a later age of life. To begin with, an individual may be quite unaware of these influences. Again, I am not inventing, but telling you of actual observations confirmed by spiritual investigation. After a time, he may say to himself, quote, "I do not know why I am impelled to this or that action, why I have this impulse. Something is urging me to think quite differently now about certain things." Close quote. Subsequently, he may have a very striking dream. Little heed is paid to things of the kind nowadays, but people will gradually become aware that it is not the form, but the content of the dream that is of importance. From this, you may conclude that if Edison had made his discoveries in a dream, they would have been just as effective. Suppose someone dreams that an unknown person comes to him, a person he cannot even think of as an acquaintance, indeed cannot place at all. This person comes into his life of dream, and various things happen. Finally, he realizes that this person whom he cannot recall, who died perhaps 15 years before, is working into and influencing his life. Whereas previously he felt that certain impulses were urging him on, he is now fully aware that these impulses, in the form of a dream picture, are working into his night consciousness. This is often characteristic of the connection between impulses within us and influences working upon us in the shape of dreams. Such experiences will become increasingly familiar. And now, in conclusion, let us see how they will become familiar. Suppose someone today reads one of the many biographies of Raphael. He will get the impression that in a certain respect, Raphael stands there as a phenomenon, complete in himself, giving forth the highest and best that was in him, but so enclosed within his particular sphere of work that it is difficult to imagine him rising still higher or transcending the level he had actually reached. And again, Raphael's creative genius seems to have been alive in him from the very beginning. On the subject of its phenomenal manifestation in Raphael's early boyhood, the biographies have nothing to say. And why? The biographies give the information that Raphael's father was Giovanni Santi, who, among other activities, was also a writer. He died when Raphael was 11 years old. But before his death, he had placed the boy under the tuition of a painter. It is also known that Giovanni Santi was himself a talented painter, but that there was something in him which he could not bring to expression. We feel that there was something in the soul of Giovanni Santi which did not make itself manifest because his outer nature frustrated it. He died when the boy Raphael was 11 years old. From the very way in which Raphael develops, we can discern the source of the powers which enabled him to reach maturity and perfection so rapidly. They are the influences playing into him from his father, forces coming from the spiritual worlds. Anyone who tries to write a true biography of Raphael in the future will have to emphasize the point that Giovanni Santi, the father of Raphael, died in 1494, when the boy was only 11 years old. Giovanni Santi was a distinguished man who during his life on earth aspired to great things, and his aspirations continued when living on without frustration in the spiritual world. He was sending down to his beloved son, in the form of delicate and intimate spiritual influences, forces which his own constitution had prevented him from bringing to expression in the physical world. To say this is no disparagement of Raphael's genius, for the ground must naturally have been there. We know that he was the reincarnation of John the Baptist, and had only to receive into himself those forces which it was his particular mission to bring into manifestation at that time. Thinking of this, we can perceive the interplay between the spiritual world and the physical plane. Future study of the life of Raphael will have, at every turn, to concern itself with the influences which poured from the spiritual into the physical. Then we shall have a picture of the wholeness, of forces working around us, through us, in us. Thus will spirituality again be instilled into culture. But it must not surprise us if those who are unwilling today to listen to any suggestion of the introduction of spirituality into culture are contemptuous of this spiritual conception of the world. For it is something completely new. It is a dawning of the new power of the spirit self. And a time will come, I ask you to write this deeply into your souls, when human beings will think of the materialistic culture which is now on the way to its close as they once thought about the age preceding the flood, yearning and longing for the future culture, which, when it came, was something holy and essentially new. Theosophists, however, should not merely strive for this ideal in theory, but receive it into their very souls. They should regard it as their good karma to know about the course of human evolution and therewith of human culture. These things will have to be pondered over for a time, because I am not yet in a position to say exactly when the next lecture can take place. But we know well that time is required to make spiritual science an integral force and impulse in our hearts and minds. And we know, too, that it is a part of spiritual development not only to understand the truths, but actually to unfold all that the great ideas born from a spiritual conception of the world can say to our hearts. The end of Lecture 7.